This week in KMA Land, Shenandoah Council sets hearing on water ordinance amendment. Shenandoah Green Plains payments paused. Mid-American Wind Farm nears completion. Office space debate continues in Mills County. Sydney Council seeks fitness center ideas. And we'll remember a legendary Shenandoah educator. I'm Mike Peterson. Another water-related issue made the news in Shenandoah this week, this one involving lead pipes. By a 4-0 vote Tuesday night, the Shenandoah City Council set a public hearing for December 9th at 6 p.m. on an amendment to Chapter 90 of the city's water service ordinance regarding lead pipes. City Water Superintendent Tim Martin says the amendment requires homeowners to replace lead pipes depending on their conditions.
It says any lead found to be leaking or damaging has to be replaced as soon as possible. It says if you just find one, it's just sitting there and not doing anything wrong, it says that should be replaced within 10 years after 2027, so that you're giving them more time.
Martin says the amendment is based on Environmental Protection Agency mandates for all public drinking water suppliers throughout the country to provide a water service line material inventory by October 16, 2024. Of course, that was more than a year ago. But he says city records regarding pipe materials only go as far back as 2011.
So we didn't have any information, so I had to put down a lot of unknowns. And what that means, if you have an unknown or if you know there's a lead service line or a galvanized piping following lead, you have to send an annual letter every year to those people. So I know a lot of you guys, probably most of you in this room, have received one of them letters, mostly probably saying your service line material is unknown.
Martin estimates between 1,600 to 1,800 water service pipes in the community are of unknown material. In order to determine which residences have lead piping, he says the city plans to check potholes or hydro-excavate by looking for curb stops on each property.
And what we do is we have a machine with the pressure washer and probably a 6-inch pipe, 4-inch, and we take them just jet down next to the curb stop, about a hole about that big, so we can visually see the pipe and take a photo of it, and then we'll just put dirt back in it and move on to the next house. So there's no backhoe, no mini excavator, none of that stuff.
Well, Martin says the city plans checking any residence or building constructed on or before 1940 first. As Green Plains' sugar facility remains idle, so is the city of Shenandoah's payments for the project. By unanimous vote Tuesday night, the Shenandoah City Council approved an agreement finding an uncured event of default under the private development agreement between the City and Green Plains Shenandoah LLC. The resolution also authorized city staff to execute and deliver a notice of suspension. Company officials announced in March it's temporarily idling operations at its $50 million clean sugar facility in Shenandoah, only months after a host of luminaries participated in ribbon-cutting ceremonies in May 2024. Under a development agreement with the city, Green Plains received tax abatement in the project, which included the creation of 12 high-paying jobs. Since the CST plant and its workers are idle, Shenandoah City Administrator A.J. Lyman says the company is in default of the agreement.
In the case of default, council can pause payments, can cancel the agreement, can sue them and make them do something or attempt to make them do something. This, I would say, would be the best option available to council and the city and also to Green Plains, because it gives them that opportunity to get those improvements up and running again and make it profitable. Hopefully become additional jobs, which was the intent of this agreement.
Speaking on KMA's Morning Line program Wednesday morning, Shenandoah Mayor Roger McQueen says pausing payments was the best option for both the city and company.
You know, we all agree that the best thing we can do on this is just to pause this at this time, give Green Plains a chance to get organized and get their sugar plant back up and operational. And then all this does is suspend anything from going on. There's not going to be any money going anywhere. In my opinion, it's the best thing the city could do in good faith that they're going to get this up and running.
McQueen adds he's hopeful operations will eventually resume at the plant along with the jobs provided for the community. After months of construction work, a wind energy project in Page and Fremont counties nears the finish line. At its regular meeting late Tuesday afternoon, the Page County Board of Supervisors heard its weekly update from Mid-American Energy officials regarding the Shenandoah Hills Wind Project. Straddling the Page-Fremont County line south of Shenandoah, crews have been erecting just over 50 turbines over the past several months. Now, MidAmerican Energy's Kelsey Ballard says all the turbines have been constructed, with some of the turbines now spinning.
So we are in the process of getting the large equipment moved off-site, reclaiming the laydown yard. So some of those trailers will be starting to move off-site, getting lots of restoration done, and going back and working with landowners on that kind of stuff. So really a lot of what I consider project closeout type activities are what we've got in process.
Ballard adds they are still awaiting delivery of the transformer that will help finalize the project. Supervisor Todd Mayer also inquired whether any of the road rock placed on Level B roads and later pushed off by traffic could be used elsewhere. While noting she would have to follow up on a specific plan for the reclaimed rock, Ballard says in past projects, some of the material has been used on the access roads for the turbines.
Sometimes what they do is we build the access roads to the turbines, and as we're constructing the turbines, the access roads are not in as good a shape once the turbine is built as when we started off. So sometimes what they do with that reclaimed gravel, either from the Level B roads or from the turning radii or those improvements, is, you know, first look at, are there some of the turbine access roads that have been built that need additional rock, that kind of thing.
Once the access roads have been addressed, Ballard says contractors sometimes work with the county on where any additional rock could be placed.
There are some different things that they look at on the project first, if those need the gravel. And then after that, you know, whether it's working with JD or landowners or whatever, try and find a use for that gravel. So let me see if they've got the plan for that gravel specifically worked out.
Ballard says plans are still on track to finalize the project and for energy generation by the end of the year. More pieces of the funding puzzle are falling into place for a project linking two recreational destinations. Recently, the Iowa Transportation Commission announced its approval of over $3.1 million for 9 state recreational trails programs projects. Among the recipients, Page County receiving $285,000 for the Wabash Trace Wrap Park Connector Trail. Back in September, the Southwest Iowa Nature Trails Project Incorporated and the City of Shenandoah received a $600,000 grant for the project. Plans call for a 3-mile trail linking the 63-mile Wabash Trace to the 200-acre Wrap Park Recreation Area located north of Shenandoah. Wabash Trace Director Becca Castle Laughlin tells KMA News the project actually entails 4 phases.
The first would be a new trail connection from the Wabash Trace to Wrap Park on the south side of the East Neshamotna River. We'll also have a new city loop connecting Sportsman's Park to Waubonsie Park on the north side of Ferguson Road. And then there will be replacement surfacing of Sportsman's Park to the East Neshamotna Bridge, which is currently the asphalt that's in pretty poor condition. And then replacing the crushed limestone from the bridge to Highway 59 with concrete.
Laughlin says the latest grant award is a big boost for the project's funding drive.
It was obviously a big piece of the puzzle, but, you know, like you said, we've been working on this for a number of years. I think it's been at least in the idea stage for more than 10 years, and things have just kind of come together in the last couple years with the opportunity to apply for the Destination Iowa funding. Really kind of ramped up the process. I would like to say that without support of some local foundations, we wouldn't even be able to get to this point where we're over 90% fundraised so far.
When finished, Laughlin says the connector trail will complement both recreation destinations.
I've personally seen a lot of people that are walking or riding their bikes from Shenandoah out to Wrap Park. I think most of them are probably fishing, bird watching, but, you know, it's not very safe along A Avenue to walk that section. It'll really make a safe transportation option to get from Shenandoah to Wrap Park.
Roughly $2.6 of the $2.9 million project has been raised. If all goes well, Laughlin says ground will be broken for the project in July, with construction beginning next fall. The raging debate over office space continues in Mills County. At its regular meeting Tuesday morning, the Mills County Board of Supervisors unanimously approved moving the county's VA office from its current location at 602 South Locust Street to the county annex building at 403 Railroad Avenue January 15th, pending that a moving company is available at that time. Much of Tuesday's discussion focused on the office space of the annex and how it would be obligated to Veterans Affairs. By a 2-1 vote, the board approved having VA staff occupy the two offices currently used by Public Health Administrator Caitlin Mertfeld, Community Health Care Worker Ben Berberich, and Home Health Care staff, as well as the reception area. While acknowledging that the proposal would require relocating public health staff to the center office and conference room, Supervisor Richard Crouch says the offices are accessible and have windows, something he says Veterans Affairs staff indicated would be beneficial.
Talking with the office down there now, they have some people that have problems of being concealed, I guess you could call it, confined. They like to see out in the open and things, so I know it's a move for public health, but we are a county of more than 3,000 veterans. We are the number one county in the state of Iowa. Take care of our veterans, and I wouldn't want to see anything in front of that.
Supervisor Jack Sayers cast the lone dissenting vote and initially made a motion to grant the VA staff the reception area, a center office, and the conference room, leaving public health where they are currently located. That motion failed by a 2-1 vote, with Sayers as the lone vote in favor. In addition to the back office actually being closer to the front door measurement-wise, Sayers also questioned why they would relocate 4 to 5 employees under the larger offices for the two VA staff.
Looking at the square footage of it, Caitlin's office is 307 square feet. We're going to put one person in a room with 307 square feet. I don't think that's necessarily a good use of our space. I don't think that that is a working model. I don't think that that adds up. I understand wanting to be in the front. I understand wanting to be more accessible, but when you actually look at the data, they are more accessible in the other offices. And that was measured yesterday by our facilities manager, Chad.
Sayers notes windows could also be installed in the back office. While understanding wanting to have Veterans Affairs near the front of the building, he adds that residents having easy access to public health services, such as the ones provided by Burbridge, is also important.
And then Burbridge, who works with General Relief, who works with different groups like SNAP and SIRHA, he has people that come in all the time too to discuss about their traumatic experiences, to talk about what has gone in their life and how they can get the support that they need too. So, I mean, no matter what, if we change the offices, there are downsides.
Well, no formal action was taken. The board also discussed future changes to the annex building. Discussion is underway on a proposed fitness center in Sydney. At its regular meeting this week, the Sydney City Council discussed a possible lease agreement with the Sydney School District to utilize space under the elementary school gym as a fitness center for community members. Sydney Mayor Justin Shirley tells KMA News after the school moved the majority of its weightlifting equipment to the junior-senior high school, the district allowed some public access to the space. But the mayor says the city continued to require more workout equipment through donations and grants.
Well, once they did the renovations, they have their weightlifting facility out there, and interimly, the city has owned a few pieces of equipment that remain in that elementary gym, and the school was granting access via FOB to members of the public if they wanted to come in and get one, so they'd be able to use that, but that just hasn't been a sustainable model from an upkeep standpoint.
Shirley says the city approached the district about a potential lease agreement, but the school is waiting to hear back from the state fire marshal before any contract is finalized.
The council maybe is interested in looking at other opportunities as well, just in case that ends up not being an option long term, since the city does own quite a bit of equipment now that was purchased through grants and donations. And we want to give the public an opportunity to use those. So
Shirley adds the agreement would allow the city to oversee the workout area as an official fitness center for residents.
The city would be able to lease that space and then handle the membership side of things for a fitness center on our end and assume the, you know, day-to-day cleaning duties and general upkeep, to where the school doesn't have to manage that when it's really not part of anything that their students are using now.
And Shirley says the hope is to have the workshop with the council in December to further review possible facility options if a lease agreement isn't feasible.
To see if there's opportunities to spur some sort of new construction of a fitness facility, or potentially the new construction of a city public works shop at our lagoons, and then maybe be able to utilize our current shop as a fitness center. So those were some of the ideas and discussions that were thrown out by the council.
In other business Monday, the council also heard a second proposal on the GIS mapping of the city's utilities from Bolton and Mink. They called her Miss C. Shenandoah residents this week mourn the loss of a legendary educator in the community. Barb Cunningham died last Thursday night at the age of 84. Cunningham taught physical education for 35 years in the Shenandoah School District and substituted for 10 years. In August 2023, Cunningham received the Iowa State Education Association's Sue Welly Award for distinguished service at its conference in Des Moines. In an interview with KMA News shortly after receiving the award, Cunningham talked about her relationship with teachers' organizations, which dated back to her arrival in Shenandoah in 1965 after graduating from Emporia State University in Kansas.
Mr. Logan said, "You will join the association, of course, it's a professional organization that you want to join." But I knew about that kind of thing anyway because I went to, quote, teachers' college. We knew about joining the NEA group. So, of course, I joined the Shenandoah Education Association, affiliated with the Iowa State Education Association and the National Education Association.
Over the years, Cunningham served on various SEA committees as well as its president. She also served as president of the regional Uniserve unit. A lifetime National Education Association member, Cunningham served two terms on the NEA's board of directors from 2010 to 2016. Cunningham cited the importance of education as the reason for remaining active in the ISEA and other organizations.
Once an educator, always an educator is what I feel, you know, is in my blood. I wanted to be a teacher when I was in middle school, and why would I want to change just because I retired? Education, public school education, is the most important part of this democracy in my feelings. You know, that's what we do. We help every other profession there is.
Cunningham says being retired allowed her to keep up on state and national issues regarding education.
When you're teaching, your time really goes towards your students more, and you don't have time to keep on top of all these issues. And retired, we know what's going on. We know what the legislature is doing, and we have time to contact them and to give them our opinion and get their focus on public education.
A celebration of life memorial service for Barb Cunningham took place Tuesday afternoon at the Shenandoah United Methodist Church. Memorials go to the Shenandoah, Iowa Education Foundation Barbara Cunningham Miss C Education Scholarship. This month marked the anniversary of a disastrous and heartwarming moment in Shenandoah history. November 20th marked the 30th anniversary of the fire that destroyed the Depot restaurant and the community effort to rebuild the structure. Owner Bill Hillman purchased the former Burlington Northern Train Depot in 1983. After a long restoration process, Hillman tells KMA News the restaurant was preparing for a major milestone on that day.
We had just paid off our loan on the depot the Friday before that. So we closed Sunday and did a deep cleaning of the depot. All the employees came in and celebrated and did a deep cleaning and added some stuff to the kitchen and just got everything ready to open for our first day of breakfast.
Then disaster struck at around noon.
There was a kitchen fire and we pulled the fire extinguisher thing and that blew an opening through the hood system and blew some fire into the attic, and it was a false attic. Fire department was there within 2 or 3 minutes, but just couldn't get at the fire.
It took up to 6 hours for firefighters to finally bring the fire under control. By the time it was over, only a floor and 4 walls were left of the structure. Fortunately, Hillman says most of the memorabilia inside the restaurant was saved by evacuating employees and customers.
As the smoke was filling up in the building, they'd take things off the walls and memorabilia and antiques and take them out and put them in the yard. And so a lot of things were saved that were on the walls and antiques, that kind of stuff that meant something to me and to Shenandoah history.
With little insurance money, Hillman faced a major challenge in cleaning and rebuilding the business. Thanks to an army of volunteers, Hillman says those efforts began the day after the fire.
I showed up the next day to start picking up stuff. There were about 100 people there. With wheelbarrows and shovels and crowbars and everything needed to clean the place up, and it was very heartwarming.
Some of the same volunteers pitched in with the rebuilding effort, which began December 1st. Enough work was accomplished that the business reopened for the employees' annual holiday party on Christmas night. 2 months later, the depot reopened to customers. Three decades later, Hillman is thankful for the community's love and support that helped the restaurant rise from the ashes.
That's the only way it happened, was the support from the community and all my friends and even people I didn't know showed up to help. And well, Joe Niebel was a carpenter that could direct everything. And we just worked really hard at doing something that couldn't have been done without a community like Shenandoah.
And also, Hillman thanked the area's financial institutions for their encouragement in reopening. One of KMA-Land's leading indicators finds the region's economy in the doldrums heading into the Christmas shopping season. November's Rural Main Street Index report totals 44.0. That's up from October's 34.6, but the survey of bank CEOs in a 10-state region, including Iowa, Nebraska, and Missouri, sank below growth neutral for the ninth time this year. Speaking on KMA's Morning Line program Monday morning, Creighton University economics professor Dr. Ernie Goss cites optimism over a potential trade deal with China as one reason for the index's slight uptick. Another reason is the Federal Reserve's recent interest rate cut.
Things are just getting a bit better because of just the negatives are getting less negative. We're going to see rates have come down a little bit. That'd be short-term interest rates, and that's good for the farm economy, the agricultural economy. And we're probably going to see another, it's 50-50 right now, whether we'll get a rate cut on December the 10th. I'm on the side of another rate cut. And, of course, that's going to be helpful for the agricultural economy, which is very important, of course, to this part of the country.
However, in November's report, one in three bankers, less than 32%, indicated the rural economy was in a recession. Goss says low commodity prices continue to bog down the region's economy.
The prices out there for corn, soybean, wheat, not good at all. Beef, of course, has been strong, but that's good news if you got beef to sell. And that's also a part. And also higher costs. For example, we're talking about fertilizer costs being up, but other costs as well.
And Goss says better trade deals and lower interest rates may signal improved economic conditions in 2026.
We'll have to wait and see how much retaliation we get from some of our trading partners. When we've raised our tariffs, they've responded by raising their tariffs. Now, fortunately, we've not seen much of that action in Mexico. The chief trading partner for grain sales, and that's particularly important for Iowa, selling grain into Mexico.
Approximately 58.3% of bankers expect farmland prices to fall in 2026, with an average decline of 31.3% for all survey participants. Though the new hiring index increased from 44.0 last month to 49.5 this month, Goss says plans to close Lexington, Nebraska's Tyson Foods plant may negatively impact the rural job market.
Now, we've had a closure. A big, largest beef packing plant in America is closing in Lexington, Nebraska. Of course, that spills over every 3,200 jobs. There will be another 3,200 lost in non-farm.
Though the federal government's 39-day shutdown recently ended, Goss says the uncertainty it created for farmers remains.
Farmers are attempting to plan, of course, what happens in farm support payments from the federal government. Very important. It's really hard to get a read on what's going on there. The president's promised certain support levels, and of course, that would be helpful to the agricultural economy, but it has a lot to do with uncertainty, and uncertainty is playing a big part in terms of trade, in terms of U.S. farm policy.
One possible boost to the local economy in retail sales is spurred by the Christmas buying season. That's why Goss joins the chorus of local officials repeating one message: buy local.
When your local providers are providing competitive prices and good services, buy locally. It spills over and is much better for the rural economy, the local economy, than buying from outside the area.
Creighton University economics professor Dr. Ernie Goss. That wraps up this week in KMA Land. Be listening each week at this time for This Week in KMA Land. For more information all the time, log on to KMALand.com. You can also hear this program in its entirety. For KMA News and the entire KMA News staff, this is Mike Peterson. Have a great remainder of the Thanksgiving Day holiday. This Week in KMA Land is a presentation of KMA News, keeping the region informed for 100 years of service.